Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Today, we want to spend some time looking at the world of data that we now live in. Your emails, the lovely lady on your smartphone giving you directions, baseball.
This is the code that I've written for our year-to-year projections. This is building in all the intelligence that we have to project players.
Okay.
It's about getting things down to one number. Using stats the way we read them, we'll find value in players that nobody else can see.
A scene from the film Moneyball about how Oakland A's manager Billy Beane used data to identify future stars. Researchers apparently also troll the web looking for spikes in Google searches of symptoms for the flu. It tells them patients will be heading for the emergency room. They look at Google searches for real estate. They may be the best way to predict home sales. Our guest, Eric Brynjolfsson, says all this web search data is like having ESP. Eric is director of the Center for Digital Business and a professor at the Sloan School of Management at MIT. He tells us that the New York Police Department analyzes web search patterns to decide where to send more patrol officers. And Eric, we may not be at the level Tom Cruise was in the film Minority Report, you know, predicting crime, but we've got information from Google, Firefox, info from sensors in our cars, weather sensors. It seems endless.
What's emerging is something that some people call the Internet of Things. Literally trillions of devices are being scattered all over the planet. It's like the planet is becoming alive, having a skin that is in touch now with the nervous system.
We have cameras on your bike helmet.
Yeah, and it's connected to the Internet. So all that information is fed in, and people share it voluntarily, and much of it is collected automatically. And so many of these sensors are just communicating with each other in real time. We're just beginning to tap into using it. There are, of course, some privacy issues that emerge from that, and there are some opportunities to make people much, much better off.
Hold that for a second, because first of all, I have a couple things. I love when you said it's like the Earth has a skin.
Yes.
And it's as if it's been hooked up for this EKG, right? And
the whole
thing is being tested. But you have hard data that shows that companies that take advantage of analyzing all of this data do what, 5% better?
Right, that's exactly right. So we've been looking at this for a while, using it ourselves, and then there are many, many anecdotes and examples of particular companies that did something with big data, many of them internet companies. Ironically, until we did the study, there wasn't any large-scale data-driven analysis. So we gathered data. We got data on about 179 companies, American companies, and we basically interviewed people there to see how data-driven they were, and we ranked them on a scale of how intensively they use data. And then we compared that to a separate data set of their financial performance. And what we found was that the firms that were most data-driven were about 5% more productive than their industry peers.
Well, and you also say, and this is kind of alarming, that in much the same way that there is an income inequality in the U.S. that we've been talking about quite a bit, and that gap has grown larger, you say that the same kind of gap is starting to show up between different kinds of American companies?
Yeah, it's interesting. So in a different study, not the data-driven one, but a related study, we looked at what was happening to the performance of companies in the U.S., and what we found is that gap between the leaders and the laggards has gotten bigger and bigger, especially in the past 10 years. It's just exploded. So just as the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer on an individual basis, the same thing is happening with companies. And we found that was strongly correlated with the use of information technology.
And give me just a quick, brief sense of what you're talking about if some CEO is listening and his or her ears have picked up. What are they doing with the data? So in other words, every company probably feels like, well, wait a minute, I keep an email list of all my clients. You know, what are they doing, the ones that are doing it?
Well, what's happening more and more is analysis and prediction. So a company like Amazon, for instance, carefully analyzes what people look at on their website, and then they do experiments where they do simple things like changing the recommendation engine or maybe moving the shopping cart from the left to the right. They do hundreds of these experiments every day, and whether it's within a few weeks or in some cases within a few hours, they get enough data to come in to tell them that this particular recommendation algorithm leads to better results, makes their customers more likely to buy or makes them have higher customer satisfaction. Putting the shopping cart on the right gives them an extra 0.1% of likelihood that people will complete the sale than if they do on the left. And they're just continuously learning and optimizing every way that they run their business.
This reminds me of how broadcast media, you know, decades ago started focus groups. So mm-hmm. you'd have people sit and watch something and then take in information about what they saw. Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where you would wire people up so that you could actually feel how they felt. And it got to the point where they could tell you every single word you said on air, how someone reacted to it, if they liked it, you know, every single word. It sounds like that's what...
This is happening, but you don't have to wire individual people up. You're drawing on the world's largest focus group, which is the internet and the web, and people are voluntarily typing in, so these terabytes of data are just already being created and in most cases collected, and all that's missing is for people to sit down and analyze them. And when they do that, there's a fundamental change in the way decisions get made in companies. The old way is what my friend at Microsoft likes to call the approach of using hippos, which is going with the highest paid person's opinion. HIPPO is an acronym for that. And they're moving towards a data-driven approach where instead of going with a person's opinion, they use this data and it can tell them for sure which particular approach is working and which one isn't. That's a sea change.
I just want to make sure I heard you right. So they'd go with the highest paid person's opinion, meaning what? They'd go ask the CEO of a company?
Well, it's a bit of a joke, but typically the way companies have made decisions for thousands of years is a group of people sit around a table and they talk about the choices and the decisions, and then at the end of the meeting, the highest paid person at the table is the one who decides.
And there's a part of me that thinks, do we lose something if we're not doing that anymore? Do we lose some sort of human interaction, whether or not it's the highest paid person? It's somebody in the company who has a gut feeling, who has a vision, who has a belief in something, and then they carry it out, as opposed to the highest paid person being the data cruncher.
So you can subject that to data. And maybe there's a bias built into this, but we had the same question. Do you lose something? Does it make a difference? You know, you hear about anecdotes about companies doing great, and maybe some other companies where there's a person with a great gut feel who's got this vision.
Steve Jobs comes to mind. Didn't use data crunching, I don't think.
Not particularly, exactly. So the way we answered this was getting a very large sample, and we found that on average, the data-driven companies were about 5% more productive. Now, that didn't mean that every single data-driven company was more productive than every single company relying on intuition, but those were the broad averages.
Eric Brynjolfsson is director of the Center for Digital Business and a professor at MIT. He's been telling us companies that know what to do with this treasure trove of data have a leg up on companies that aren't using it to make decisions. But Eric, I'm wondering, could you end up reversing this? Have a goal based on your gut and then arrange the data to achieve it?
There's two important points there. One is that the data-driven approach doesn't work for all decisions. So part of the art is understanding when you can use the data and when they're helpful and when we just don't have the right kind of data available, something we're learning to do better. The second point, I think, is a subtler cultural one, and I think it's even more important than the availability of the data, and that's the mindset of how you use the data. Most companies, if you ask them, they'll say, oh, yeah, we use data, but the reality is that they're using it to confirm a decision that they already made.
Exactly.
You go into a typical business board meeting, and there's pie charts and bar charts and information up there, but more often than not, the presenter has already come to a conclusion, or his or her boss has come to a conclusion, and they've asked, go out and get the data to support this decision. That is not what I would call true data-driven decision-making. To really do it right, you have to be much more humble and step back and say, I don't really know for sure what the answer is. I'm going to let the data speak. And I'm not this big shot boss who knows all the answers. Instead, I'm somebody who's inquiring into what the right answer is. I'm going to put a hypothesis out there. If the data support it, great, we'll go with it. If the data don't support it, then we'll go with the other solution. That's a very culturally different mindset that most companies have a lot of trouble adapting to. Most managers have a lot of trouble adapting to. And to me, that's the real barrier between where we are today in most companies and where we need to be with the big data revolution.
In fact, do you see American management maybe resisting this?
Tremendously. There's a huge resistance because so many managers have been implicitly or explicitly trained that you have to be confident and go out there. Whether or not you really know the answer, you have to project this sense that, okay, I'm the visionary who knows what needs to be done. And maybe there are a few people, Steve Jobs comes to mind, that can pull that off in a legitimate way. But for most people, they're not getting as good a decision as they could by ignoring what the data are saying. It's a much more scientific mindset. And as I said, the shift from hippos to data-driven is an example of that. An analogy I try to use with my students is what happened when the microscope was introduced 300 years ago. Antony van Leeuwenhoek developed a better microscope and for the first time looked inside a drop of water or drop of blood and saw these little microbes, he called them animalcules, swimming around in there. Nobody believed him at first. They said, you know, you're crazy to think that an animal can be shrunk down into a drop of water. But of course, eventually other people looked through the same microscopes and realized, my God, he's right. And biology and medicine have never been the same. Today, we are getting much, much more fine-grained measurement of what's going on inside of our organizations and between companies and with our customers, not 10% better, but hundreds or thousands of times more fine-grained resolution as to what is the information that's flowing between people and companies. And I think it's going to have a similar revolutionary impact on the way we do management.
Well, I'm taking a couple things from this. First of all, I love the research that shows, crunching the data, that if you're in a job search, actually the people that you don't know the best, the people in your social networks that you have, they're like on your fourth rung out.
The weak ties.
The weak ties, is that right. they're more likely to be where you find a job?
Yes, that's true.
Why is that?
It's because the people who you know well are often very similar to you. They're in the same social circle. So if you want to learn something new, you have to stretch a little bit, and those almost by definition are people that you aren't as closely linked to.
Those jobs that you may be looking for, more and more of them are going to be in this world of data.
Right.
Who qualifies for this world? Who would be a good candidate for jobs in this world of data crunching?
You don't need to have a very sophisticated mathematical background to be effective in using big data. In fact, we found that often the simplest models are the best ones because there's so much data available that the answer will just pop out if you frame the question correctly. And the real art and science to doing that is knowing a bit about the domain that you're looking at. So it's this combination of knowing a bit about what kind of data are available, what kind of clickstream and page views and mobile phone data are available, and also knowing enough about the domain you're looking at, whether it's retailing or medicine or law, to be able to formulate the hypothesis in a meaningful way. And having the intersection of those two types of skills is really the sweet spot. It's not being a rocket scientist, statistician.
Is it being the number cruncher? I mean, that's kind of, you know, number cruncher equals pocket pen and maybe a little boring.
You have
boring.
To be comfortable working with numbers, absolutely.
But I'm talking about the boring part. You know, no, I'm saying, you know, is it boring?
That's the most exciting part. So unfortunately, you have to miss out on the really exciting equations that we teach at MIT. You don't necessarily need the nth degree of statistical knowledge. There's a huge creative element to this. Crunching the numbers is actually the less difficult part. Creatively formulating the question is where the real value gets added.
Well, as to your comparison to the microscope, we remember that when this happened, you said people didn't believe the inventor, but also you could see things that had been invisible. And there was a crisis because these were things that were not mentioned in the Bible.
Yes.
Yes, so there was an existential crisis, if you will. Do you see an analogy today?
I believe so. There's a management Bible. It's not quite as canonical as the Holy Bible, but there are a lot of myths and beliefs about how management works that have never really been rigorously scientifically tested.
I'm thinking, too, of the consumer, you know, rejecting this notion that they could be that predictable once the data's crunched.
Well, they can reject it, but that won't stop people from predicting their behavior and often with frighteningly accurate results.
That's Eric Brynjolfsson, director of the Center for Digital Business and a professor at the Sloan School of Management at MIT. By the way, his recent book is Race Against the Machine, How the Digital Revolution is Accelerating Innovation, Driving Productivity, Irreversibly Transforming Employment and the Economy. You can kick and scream. It's happening. Eric, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin.